Think climate change is a dead issue in America? Think again. Around the country, cities, states, and big companies are throwing their weight behind climate solutions, setting ambitious policy, and investing hundreds of billions of dollars. While federal policy is bogged down in politics, how are these actors keeping America in the game on this critical global issue? Stay tuned for an upcoming special branded episode of Global Translations, brought to you by Citi. We'll hear from Ed Schuyler. He is the Executive Vice President for Global Public Affairs at Citi, and Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, about the policy and financial tools we have to meet the scale of our environmental challenges. Listen for that episode on September 5th, wherever you get this podcast.
Imagine a giant environmental problem, one that's linked to air pollution, in which one factory or one power plant in one country can emit pollution that will damage the environment and hurt people's health in another country. It's going to take international negotiation, cooperation, and imposing real costs on industry and on consumers to solve it. It sounds like an impossible problem.
Well, it wasn't back in 1991.
That's Matt Daly. He's Politico's energy and environment editor.
That's when the U.S. and Canada got together and took on the problem of acid rain.
Acid rain has poisoned America's lakes and eaten away at its monuments.
Acid rain stemmed from pollution, NOx and SOx.
NOx and SOx.
Yeah.
It sounds like two cats.
Yeah, much less cute, though. It's nitrous oxide and sulfur dioxide. These are pollutants that basically come from coal-fired power plants. Coming back down to Earth in rainfall, it was damaging plants. It was damaging wildlife. It was poisoning our streams. It was ruining agriculture, wrecking buildings. I mean, this was a real problem. Everyone saw the problem, and they came together to take action.
Well, 1991, you're talking about George H.W. Bush, a Republican, and back then, Canada's prime minister was Brian Mulroney, a conservative. So it sounds like this wasn't a big partisan or ideological issue at the time.
That's right. This was a problem that everyone realized needed to be addressed. And they did it.
So how did they fix it?
Well, they came up with an agreement.
Discussions with Canada leading to an accord that...
A series of steps that they would take. Among those steps were using some technology that they'd developed. They put devices on power plants that took these pollutants out of the waste streams that went into the atmosphere. They put in place cap and trade programs, much has been suggested for climate change. And lo and behold, they managed to sharply reduce these pollutants.
So why is it that in the early 90s, Canada and the United States could come together and solve acid rain, but it seems so difficult for countries to come together around climate change? What's the difference?
Well, the biggest difference is really scale. When you're looking at acid rain, you could go back and you could say, aha, here's the source of this pollution. We need some mechanism in place to stop these pollutants from being emitted. When you're talking about climate change, you're looking at a much, much bigger issue. Carbon emissions are everywhere. Our entire economy is a carbon-based economy. So if you're talking about reducing carbon dioxide, the most important greenhouse gas, you're talking about a fundamental reordering of the economy. We need to figure out a way that our economy can grow without using more carbon. The two things were almost, they were linked at the hip. Your economy rises, carbon emissions go up. Your economy drops, carbon emissions drop. Example A, Soviet Union collapse. That reduced worldwide emissions dramatically because their economy was gone. So when you're talking about fighting climate change versus, say, protecting the ozone layer or fighting acid rain, you're looking at a scale of problem that's much different. Carbon is so much more intertwined in our economic output, fossil fuel being the major driver. You have to get fossil fuels out of transportation, out of electricity generation. You have to deal with issues from agriculture. You have to deal with the idea that factories are using fuels that are themselves causing climate change. Once you get past the power plants and once you get past the cars, then the really hard stuff comes. Then it comes to, guess what? Now we've got to deal with agriculture and land use. The scale of the problem is hard to wrap your head around.
Over our next three episodes, we'll be talking about climate change. This is the quintessential borderless problem that can only be solved when individual countries take domestic action. And like trade and technology, it's an area where the United States and China play an outsized role that impacts the rest of the world. From Politico, this is Global Translations. I'm Louisa Savage. So I want to talk about the Paris Climate Agreement, but first, can you just chart what was happening in domestic and global climate policy in the years leading up to Paris? You've been watching this for a long time.
Sure. Well, I guess the first real benchmark year would have probably been 1992. That was the year of the first Earth Summit. That was the Rio UN Earth Summit. George Herbert Walker Bush attended for the U.S., and he signed on to the compact there that really created the framework organization inside the UN to fight climate change. Now, this is amazing, too, because it was a Republican who did this back in 1992, just to show you how much the world has changed.
Well, I remember being a high school kid during the Earth Day of 1992 when it was a really big deal and we were doing all these activities and activating around it. That was a really long time ago.
It was. It was a really long time ago.
But the problem is itself accelerating.
The problem is accelerating. I mean, look, this goes back to the early science on this goes back to the 70s and the 80s.
The greenhouse effect has been detected.
It's when people started noticing the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. They started speculating that the planet was going to warm. This was going to change the way we live.
And it is changing our climate now.
So 1992 sees the beginning of the UN processes around this, really. That's really when it kicked off. That led directly into, a few years later, the Kyoto Protocol, which was an agreement that came out of this UN process at the Kyoto meeting, Kyoto, Japan. That was in 1997. Now, this was really the first time anybody had come up with a piece of paper that said, you countries are going to cut your greenhouse gas emissions. So that required actual steps from these countries. These were going to be legally binding targets. In fact, they adopted this. This was the plan. That led to a really that's when industry and opponents really got motivated to push back on this. They said, this is going to damage our economy. This is going to hurt our country. We're going to put people out of work. You're going to ruin our economic growth. This is a real threat to us.
Was this the moment it became polarized?
The U.S. has long played the role of spoiler here. The European Union was the one who tended to be the one really pushing the most aggressive solutions. Even back when Clinton was president and with Al Gore pushing him to take aggressive action, the U.S. was seen as still sort of putting the brakes on things a little bit. Hold on, let's take this a little slower, let's really consider what we're doing here. It's going to have a major impact on the U.S. economy, on the world economy. So the U.S. has always been seen as a little bit of a drag here. But when George W. Bush took office, he basically just completely tossed that whole book out and said, we're not doing anything. This isn't really a priority for us. He came from Texas. He was an oil man. He brought in a very different mindset.
One of the major complaints that all the American allies had against Bush's foreign policy was, you know, basically turning his back on global warming.
That's Politico reporter Darren Samuelson, who covered climate during that time.
In Indonesia, at the UN Climate Conference, there's one every year, every December. Indonesia was 07. I remember I was in Bali, Indonesia, and the American delegation got booed.
We would like to find a way forward here. We are not prepared to accept, though, this formulation at this time.
Thank you. Thank you, United States.
Bush's people were booed for resisting, you know, trying to sign on to what would become, 7 years later, the Paris Climate Agreement. But there was earlier versions of it, and the Americans were just hated.
Yeah, and it's like Darren said, the global community was very frustrated with the United States by the end of the Bush administration.
Which on a lot of fronts, right?
On many fronts. I mean, look, climate change was clearly not a priority for the W. Bush administration. The U.S. was involved in two wars. The economy at the time was tanking. You know, this was a real opportunity, and Obama took it for hope and change, right? He stepped in and said, time to make a change here.
And Matt, I remember sitting in Iowa in a small caucus room, I think it was a public library, and watching people come to caucus for the different presidential candidates. And people were coming in. And, you know, in the caucuses for the Democrats, you have a group of people whose candidate doesn't get enough votes, so they have to pick an alternative candidate. So all these people, their friends and neighbors, are trying to persuade them to come into their camp. So the Biden people came in and they had this multi-point plan for saving foreign policy, and they were trying to make all their foreign policy points. And then the Clinton people came in and they were all sort of middle-aged and older, and they were making their appeal by saying, do it for your daughters. And then the Obama people came in, and I mean, it was just a horde of them, and they were all super young, and they were talking about issues like climate and the environment. And they all said, are you just going to sit there, or are you going to be a part of something? And it was the sense that there was a movement and that Obama was sort of riding this wave, and the expectations were incredibly high about what he would accomplish.
He was seen as the antidote to George W. Bush. He was gonna right the ship. These activists looked at him and they said, this is the guy. He is a generational change maker. He is the person who sees the problem. He not only sees the problem, he wants to take the problem on.
From now, we will be able to look back and tell our children that this was the moment.
This was the moment. Like, right. it's quite
right.
A clip.
When the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal, this was the moment.
And for people on climate change, that was a big moment. We are now going to take the steps. The U.S., the world's largest polluter of greenhouse gases, is going to step up and take a leadership role in here. Obama made that promise to us. Obama pledged that to the world.
Okay, so here we are. The world has been waiting for its climate savior. In walks Barack Obama. So what happens then?
So the domestic agenda sort of got short-circuited after the midterm elections in 2010. Now, prior to that, the Recovery Act that Obama pushed through did include a lot of money for renewables, and that actually was a really big stimulus that got solar and got wind development rolling. But after that, 2 years later, he's got no Congress to move things through. He's now basically stuck with, as he said, his pen and his phone. On the climate front, the focus turns a little bit more to this UN process.
So I give you one story.
Jonathan Pershing was one of the key negotiators for the U.S. in the Paris Climate Agreement. He's academic, professorial, and the consummate diplomat.
There's a lovely saying in diplomacy, and this is a slogan that my wife made for me on a T-shirt that she gave early in my career. It says, diplomacy is the art of letting someone else have your way. And in some sense, I think that's really apt, because the objective here is to get an outcome. And to do that, other people have to see themselves in the solution.
It was Pershing's job to get dozens and dozens of other countries to see themselves as part of the solution to global climate change. As part of the Paris Climate Agreement, individual countries set their own targets.
Fundamentally, we approached it from a really different way than prior efforts. Historically, what people have done is to say, we'll allocate the obligation. We'll tell the U.S. how much they have to do, and we'll tell the Europeans what they have to do, and we'll tell the Chinese what they have to do. And it's a top-down agreement, and everyone's number is dictated. We went the other way. We started at the other end and said, what can you do? You tell us, and we'll see whether we think that's enough. And if we think it's enough, that's what you'll incorporate into the commitment that you make, which will be written into the Paris Agreement. And by doing that, countries themselves came forward with their commitments. And we could add them up and see what they were in their aggregate. And if it was enough to meet the objectives that we'd had, we can then go forward. And if it's not, we could iterate. We could ask countries to go back to the drawing board and try to find a bit more. And the political pressure that was brought to bear one country on the next, often bilaterally, sometimes as groups, gave us the capacity to get to more and more stringent numbers.
Who came up with that idea? I mean, who came up with this, like, changing the whole approach, which is kind of interesting.
I actually give an enormous amount of credit to what for many people was a failed international negotiation that had occurred a number of years before in 2009 in Copenhagen. I think it was an exercise led by Denmark. They were the host of the meeting and the chair of the negotiations, and some really brilliant diplomacy work was done there. A number of academics had written about a very different bottom-up model instead of a top-down model. And it took the years between Copenhagen and Paris for it to mature to the point where you could get a global agreement, as opposed to getting piecemeal activities and, frankly, less than fully effective outcomes. And so once again, you and the delegation that you're working with are out there sharing the effects, the consequences, the understanding, the messaging around the agreement that's been reached in each of these areas and how it adds up to a package that, while not perfect for anyone, is acceptable for everyone. And the UN process and the
So basically, the fact that you got an agreement sounds like a minor miracle.
It's a huge thing. You have 195 countries all squabbling over every single issue, and you have to do this by consensus. It's not a vote process. It's not a majority wins. You have to have no one block the final outcome, which means that everybody has to accept what you get. That's a huge order, and that happened in Paris.
Hey, everybody. Today's a historic day in the fight to protect our planet for future generations. Last month, the United States and China, the world's two largest economies and largest emitters, formally joined that agreement together. And today, the world has officially crossed the threshold for the Paris Agreement to take effect.
Okay, Matt, so now we're in late 2015. It's been years of effort internationally to get to this moment. We had the false start at Copenhagen. We had before that the Bush administration and the frustration with that. So finally, there's an agreement. And this is the culmination of Obama's vision and his work. He's bringing in all these unilateral executive actions to try to implement some of this stuff domestically. And then there's a presidential election.
Right.
And everyone thinks it's going to be Hillary Clinton, except it's not.
Everyone thought that. Everyone came out of Paris thinking the wheels are turning now. Now we're finally taking the action that we've known we've needed to take for 20 years. But then Donald Trump gets elected.
All of this with the global warming and
the country that helped bring us this Paris deal under Obama has now elected someone who says climate change is a hoax.
It's a hoax. I mean, it's a money-making
industry. This was a huge blow. This was a huge blow to the movement that felt that it had now gotten on track. And now the world's largest economy, the one who was so responsible for making this advance, is walking away from it.
Jonathan Pershing again.
Interestingly enough, the final commitment to ratify the Paris Agreement had only happened about a week before the U.S. election. I think had the election come earlier, it's not at all clear that we would have had a ratified agreement.
In fact, Jonathan told me that the 2016 election occurred right in the middle of the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Morocco, with world leaders and diplomats looking on.
People thought that Clinton, were she to become president, would not only continue Obama's policies, but further elaborate on them. And that meant that the U.S. would continue in a leadership role in pressing for a continued aggressive climate change effort globally. And therefore, if you wanted to be on the U.S.'s good side, you should play. And no one, none of the pundits, none of the analysts that we were talking to, none of the other countries thought that it was a serious likelihood that President Trump would take office or Trump would become president. In that context, therefore, the ratification was very much a function of that understanding.
So to what extent is the U.S. an outlier by pulling out?
It is unique. There is no one else who's pulled out. So the question then is, with the U.S. out, will other countries take those next steps? Not will they meet what they've already said they would do. I think mostly they'll do that. But will they do the next thing and the one beyond that if the U.S. insists on remaining an outlier? That's a much more problematic scenario.
When the U.S. stepped back, we worked extremely hard to try to convince the Trump administration to stay in the Paris Agreement.
Catherine McKenna is Canada's first minister of the environment and climate change.
We used every argument, including the economic case, which is just a very clear case that the economy of the future is going to look very different. And the U.S. has a huge opportunity to be a leader in clean technologies. And so the extent you care about jobs, you should care about being part of the Paris Agreement and also holding other countries to account. But the U.S. made their decision. So Canada, then we stepped up. We decided that the U.S. used to run what was called the Major Economies Forum, which brought together countries to make sure when you got to the climate negotiations that there was some momentum, there was some common understanding. And so we decided, Canada, which is not, we're big in size, but not in population, we decided that we needed to have China at the table and the European Union. So I proposed that we have a ministerial on climate action. And this is very important because you do need to bring folks together. And so China and the European agreed that we would co-host this, replacing the United States, who had run the Major Economies Forum. We called it Ministerial on Climate Action. And we just, the first one was in Canada, in Montreal. And that was tough because it was right after the U.S. had kind of announced their position. But we brought folks together, and it's important that we keep China very engaged in the table. I think they certainly believe in climate action, and they see the opportunity. We need them at the table. And the European Union, we just had our third ministerial this June. And I think it was highly successful because climate is about momentum and about everyone feeling that we're moving forward. And so it was a blow when the United States pulled out. But the reality is we are moving forward.
Jonathan Pershing said that every other country stayed in the agreement and that most still say they intend to meet all their targets, even if some are not quite on track.
Most of the commitments that were framed under the Paris Agreement take effect as of 2025 or even 2030. So it's a little bit too early to know if countries will do what they said. At the moment, some are on track, others are further off track. The U.S. has fallen more behind than most others. China is on track. India is on track. Brazil, fallen a little bit behind. Germany, which you would have thought would have been doing much better, Germany is falling a little bit behind. England, which is now in the process of going through its Brexit exercise, England's pretty much on track. So here's a really interesting dynamic in which some are doing fairly well, even in the midst of political difficulties, others doing less well. It'll remain to be seen over the next 4 or 5 years whether people meet their 2025 numbers, and it'll be more like 10 years before we have a clear indication of whether 2030 is done. So the question then is, with the U.S. out, will other countries take those next steps? Not will they meet what they've already said they would do. I think mostly they'll do that. But will they do the next thing and the one beyond that if the U.S. insists on remaining an outlier? That's a much more problematic scenario.
Coming up, as the U.S. steps back from global leadership in climate change, where does that leave China? More in a moment.
The politics of climate change are frozen in Washington, but beyond the Beltway, action on climate is heating up faster than ever, and you don't have to look far to find it. As America walks away from the Paris Climate Agreement, cities and states are picking up the slack by setting ambitious policy, and so are the world's biggest companies.
A couple things changed. One is everybody started focusing on it. And two is the client demand really picked up.
Ed Schuyler is the Executive Vice President for Global Public Affairs at Citi. In 2014, Citi set a goal of investing $100 billion in environmental finance, and it is about to hit that target 5 years early.
One of the reasons we're able to get to $95.5 billion is because the client demand is there for sustainable transportation, for clean water, for green buildings, sustainable energy, which has increased much sharper than we had forecast.
The advanced energy economy, that's wind, solar efficiency, green buildings, electric cars, and biofuels, are a $238 billion yearly market. That's nearly the size of America's aerospace industry. Former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg says all this activity is proof that America is still a leader on climate change, despite the inaction in D.C.
We need action now. And companies started to be much more worried about the environment. Their customers wanted them to do it. Their employees wanted them to do it. And their investors wanted them to do it. And together, we have really done as much as any other country, I think. This world is changing very fast.
I'm Carol Zimmer. Coming up on September 5th, we're releasing our third branded episode of Global Translations, brought to you by our sponsor, Citi. We'll hear from Ed Schuyler and Mike Bloomberg about how cities, states, and financial institutions are setting the stage for a radical shift in energy markets and climate solutions. Stay tuned for our final installment of this branded series anywhere you listen to this podcast.
In the U.S., the Trump administration is going backwards, but some states are stepping up.
The Climate Alliance was launched in June of 2017, and it was launched in response to the Trump administration announcing its intent to withdraw from the Paris Agreement.
This is Julie Cerqueira, the executive director of the U.S. Climate Alliance.
A lot of their effort is really geared internationally towards trying to inspire the parties to the Paris Agreement to maintain their commitments. And I think there's a fear that the administration's kind of rolling back of its regulatory framework and, you know, intention to pull out of Paris will become an excuse for other countries to backslide on their commitments. And so part of this work is to show that America is still in this. Like, we are still committed to Paris. We're committed to meeting the challenge. We're working with industry, with cities, with the faith community in order to make that progress. And we're being transparent about that, and we're being accountable, but we're also holding these countries to account. We're holding them to task. And so they made these commitments. They need to deliver on that. I think a number of countries, you know, in light of the administration's position, have turned to U.S. subnationals as partners, primarily in, you know, implementation and sharing solutions. So California is like the fifth largest economy in the world, right? So, I mean, the governor of California is almost like the president of like a small country, or not even a small country, a fairly large country. And the thing is that, you know, California has just been such a leader on climate change that especially when you're in that space, to get to work with them, I think is pretty incredible. So like they're the ones who have been the innovators on everything from, you know, like methane policies to, again, what do you do about your transportation sector, you know, an economy-wide carbon market. And then they with Quebec are the only international carbon market that exists in the world, right? So they really have been like the innovators of climate policy. And so I think especially when you're in that space, like they are one of the ones that you want to work with because they're the drivers of that innovation. And they've also just done a great job in working with other countries. So they have MOUs with, you know, places like China and Mexico and Canada on everything from, you know, the recent MOU with Canada on clean cars, right? An agreement that they're going to move in the same direction. You know, it's not many subnationals that do that. And so their profile is very high, even compared to other national governments.
Well, Matt, here's what I find so incredibly striking. We've talked a lot on this podcast about this growing concern in Washington that China is a rising rival power, that it wants to dominate the technologies of the future, and that this is going to determine everything from how technologies are governed to the quality of the jobs that our kids are going to have available to them. And we heard on this podcast U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer telling Congress that playing defense on technological supremacy is really at the heart of this whole Trump administration trade war with China. They don't want China to dominate the next generation of emerging technologies. But yet, green technology seems to be an area where the U.S. just seems to be ceding leadership, perhaps even ceding the offense on investing in developing these technologies and the research and the implementation of these technologies. And so those two things, to me, just seem really at odds with each other.
Yeah. We're walking off the playing field a little bit. Now, that doesn't mean that the U.S. green energy industry isn't growing and isn't growing pretty quickly. It is. But the scale is at a completely different level in China. They have decided, you know, they have a command control economy. They can flip the switch and say, we are pouring all of this money into solar panel manufacturing. We are going to create a wind power industry. And then they can just do it. The U.S., we turn that over to the free market. You've got to compete against vested interests. And there have been some there's government help here. There have been tax incentives. There have been, you know, the Obama stimulus. These things were big. But at the level that China's doing it, they are by far the largest investor in these. And, you know, the U.S. has a lot of technical expertise. We have national labs. We have businesses. We have created a lot of this technology. And then China goes and builds a few dozen factories and builds it out. There's a lot to be gained by building it out. When you put that stuff into factories, when you put it out into, when you deploy it, that you make a lot of advances right there. China made a strategic decision. We want to be the world's leader in clean energy, and they've succeeded in doing that. They are building more. They are deploying more than anyone else.
And now we seem to be stuck slapping tariffs on Chinese solar panels.
We're doing protective measures to try to keep a little bit of that industry here in the U.S. Is it working? Maybe a little bit around the edges. But for the most part, the cheapest producer of a solar panel is going to get the business. If that panel works as well as other panels, and you can make it a little cheaper in Thailand, in Malaysia, in China, that's where it's going to be built.
The really big player on climate is now China. It's the world's biggest emitter and also the country making the biggest, most eye-popping investments in green technology. The extent to which China can be thought of as a leader on climate is complicated. We talked to Barbara Finnemore, the director of Asia Strategy for the Natural Resources Defense Council.
I was perhaps the very first person to set up an environmental NGO in China focused on clean energy back almost 25 years ago. And we faced challenges then because nobody knew what an NGO was. There were no Chinese NGOs. And people didn't understand why a foreign group would be working in China, trying to come up with innovative ideas that would help them develop in a sustainable way.
Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of China's role on the world stage?
I was in the room when it happened, when China first stepped out on the international climate negotiation stage. There was a meeting in Beijing called by China in which ministers from 40 other developing countries came together to develop a joint developing country strategy for negotiating the Framework Climate Convention. And many of those principles that came out of that meeting found themselves in the Framework Convention, particularly the idea that developed and developing countries should be treated differently in terms of their climate reduction obligations. And China was, at the time and to this day, simply acting in what it saw as its own self-interest. They wanted to continue building coal plants as much as possible to power that economic miracle. But what happened about 5 years ago is that China began to realize that this development model was not sustainable. It was leading to tremendous pollution and not in the best interest of its own citizens. So that's when China started to realize that it was in its own self-interest to cut its coal consumption, which was the main cause of its air pollution and also the main cause of its CO2 emissions. And since that time, we are seeing quite a remarkable turnaround in China's own domestic actions on climate and air pollution, and also in the positions that it's taking in the international negotiations.
I think we've all seen the images of people in Beijing wearing, you know, the white masks due to the heavy air pollution. Since China has started changing its policies over the last 5 years, has there been an improvement in air quality, or is that still far away?
Battling air pollution in China is not an easy task. Around Beijing, for example, the six provinces around Beijing burn more coal than the entire United States. And that's to power iron, steel, cement plants, and which are used in the fastest urbanization program that the world has ever seen. So China is doing a lot to cut its coal consumption. We think it's made a lot of improvements. There is some improvement. in air pollution, but a lot more still needs to be done. And we came out with a recent report that showed that if China continues to fully implement the policies that it already has in place to cut coal consumption, and if it really ramps up its energy efficiency efforts, because so much of its coal use is inefficient, China could actually cap its coal consumption by as early as next year.
Do you think that it's fair to continue to consider China a developing country? We've had a lot of conversations on this podcast about their fast movement towards attempting to become the dominant player in a lot of high-tech industries, from 5G to artificial intelligence, and the huge investments and the huge progress they're making in that. It's hard to reconcile that with the notion that this is a developing country. How do you look at it?
I don't think it's an either-or proposition. I think there are at least two Chinas right now. And in the major cities, China is a leading developed country in many areas. However, in other provinces to the west, to the south, China is still a very developing country and doesn't have the resources and the capacity to move ahead as fast as they need to without help from the central government, without help from outside organizations like ours. And so I was pleased to see that in the last conference of the parties in Poland last December, China did agree to a common standard of tracking and reporting emissions, something that it had always resisted, with extra resources for the least developed countries who need help. And I think that's the right way to move forward. And once again, I think China understands that it's in its own self-interest to develop a strong system for monitoring and reporting emissions, in part because it has launched what may become the largest carbon trading market in the world. And unless it has strong rules of the game, that whole program will not succeed.
How does China see itself in the future in the green economy? What role does it see itself playing?
China wants to be the leader in the clean energy economy. Some people say that China was slow to catch up with the Industrial Revolution and kind of lagged behind, perhaps until recently, in the dot-com revolution. But it saw the potential to lead the clean energy revolution.
Europeans, at the end of the day, have many fewer emissions than China.
Ryan Heath has been Politico's man about Brussels, who has covered the European perspective on all of this.
So from a European perspective, China is a real mixed bag.
So what was the reaction in Europe to the decision by the Trump administration to pull out from the Paris Agreement?
General horror, but no surprise. By that time, we'd seen the tweets for more than a year. We'd seen the way he behaved on the campaign trail, and he was promising this. So I think some people thought that maybe the moderates in the administration could turn it around. But they, at the end of the day, believe they can keep working with American companies, with American states. They clung to the fact that states like California wanted to be involved in that emissions trading scheme. So the Europeans have essentially tried to ignore Trump since he pulled out, and they see him as a real outlier.
From the perspective of Europe, who is really the leader in the climate change fight right now if you look across the world?
The Europeans have appointed themselves to that role, and they're a little bit self-satisfied in giving themselves that label. And so one thing I'm always telling European leaders is that it's easy for you to feel good about what you're doing because you've got relatively few natural resources to give up, so it's not as hard a call for you. You're relatively rich, so you don't have hundreds of millions of people trying to scramble out of poverty. And you also had these exceptionally dirty industries from the Soviet era. So once you cleaned them up, it was quite easy to meet your targets because every country's target is against whatever their 1990 emissions were. And that was right at the end of the Cold War. And the EU has absorbed all of these heavy polluting countries, basically shut down their coal plants in most of the cases, shifted them to renewables, got them more involved in Russian gas and so on. And it's relatively easy for Europe to say, ah, we cleaned this up. The population isn't growing and they got rid of the oldest, dirtiest stuff. And so good for Europe. But at the end of the day, they're not necessarily doing as much work as some of the other countries are to turn the ship around.
So, Matt, where does the global climate effort go from here?
Well, specifically, the UN has got the issue on its agenda at its September meeting and then again later this year in Santiago, Chile. But the main issue is whether or not countries are going to live up to their Paris promises, whether they're going to meet what they've already agreed to do and then ramp up the ambition and get it to where they can reduce emissions down to keep temperatures at least within 2 degrees. Beyond that, the 2020 election is going to have a profound impact on how the world addresses this. Since Obama left office, there hasn't been a unifying push from the United States to drive this forward. That's really been lacking in this global dynamic here. Europe has tried to step in, but without the U.S. to come in and to cajole China, to bring India along, to bring in these other players, then that international process seems to be a little bit at sea. If Donald Trump is reelected, you'll see a repeat of the 4 years where the United States sits in the back of the room and lets the discussion go on without it.
Next time on Global Translations, we'll map out the emerging politics of climate on Capitol Hill, on the presidential campaign trail, and elsewhere in the world.
Recently, there are more Republican senators willing to talk about the urgency of addressing the obviously changing climate. But coming to some agreement about what's the right mechanism, what's the right timeline, and how do we do it in a way that also then helps advance American innovation is a real challenge.
Our producer is Annie Reese. We had help on this episode from Adrian Hirsch. Dave Shaw is the executive producer of Politico Audio and the dad of two new baby twins. My thanks to my colleagues, Matt Daly, Darren Samuelson, and Ryan Heath. I'm Louisa Savage. Global Translations is presented by Citi, a leading global bank. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and listen for a branded episode from Citi about some of these same themes coming Thursday, September 5th. Thanks, and see you next week.